Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Responsible Sourcing conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance at any time, please press the star followed by the zero on your touchtone phone, and an operator will assist you. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Jeffrey Swartz. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and good morning. Thank you to all who are participating in this stakeholder engagement process at Timberland. We've said previously when we visited on the telephone like this that our belief that is, if we're going to truly demonstrate that commerce and justice are not antithetical notions, that that proof's going to be wrung out of collaborating with intense and self-interested stakeholders who share a view of what can be and who believe in what must be, and obviously, hopefully, talking about you. Each quarter, we committed to present our efforts to be a business which is accountable for its social impact by reporting transparently and engaging personally with stakeholders. And so, we created a stakeholder engagement process that you can look at on our Just Means webpage, which is justmeans.timberland.com. You'll see there reporting about these calls that we've been conducting, as well as obviously information about specific CSR strategies. It's there for you to view and to and hopefully engage with, because we believe that we really do believe that stakeholder engagement is how we're going to create real value. And today, we're looking forward to pushing that point because we're going to discuss, hopefully together, human rights in the global value chain. And so what we got for an agenda is I'm going to briefly review where we are in the that's a wild feedback going on there, guys. Anyways, I'm going to briefly review where we are in our pursuit of ensuring human dignity in the value chain, and then I'm going to invite two independent leaders. First, the Reverend David Schilling from the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and then Mindy Luber, who's the president of Ceres. They're going to advance the conversation and hopefully engage you and us in a dialogue about this challenge of three-dimensional social change, because we're going to say to each other, I think, the obvious, which is the question about whether or not we police the question of compliance in the value chain isn't a question that's open before us. The question is, how do we create value in a sustainable fashion, both within the factory and then in the context of the world that exists around the factory? So that's a challenging notion, and I say, as I say consistently, I'm not faking it, I'm telling you the truth. Timberland, we need your help and your engagement to press this agenda. I take as granted that we have a view of the mission together, which is commerce and justice. I also take as granted that there isn't an easy solution to hard questions, and so only by engaging and hopefully in dialogue like this, we'll get progress, which I know we're all after. So just briefly, a history of where this all comes from at Timberland, because I want to be respectful about context. You know that ours is I'm a third generation guy, and Timberland is a manufacturer. We always have been, and I'd like to say we always will be, because it's a big part of the family lore. My grandfather's not alive any longer, but he was the immigrant to this country that founded the company. He was a craftsman. He's like all the things that I'm not, which is to say, he's courageous, he was determined, he was entrepreneurial, he was successful, he was a tough guy. But he was a craftsman. He could do things with his hands. My wife's a painter, and I can type, right? So that's what I can do with my hands. But as a kid, I had two sensual experiences with my grandfather. One is he smelled like a factory, right? And so whenever I go into a shoe factory, I smell my grandfather. It's leathers and cements, but I miss it. That was the in the nose thing, the in the eyes thing, which little kids have, right? Is a guy who earned his living, who got daily bread for his family by using his hands to cut patterns and sew shoes. But the trick about my grandfather's hands is he was missing 3.5 fingers from one of his hands, because he was working with my dad the week before my dad's wedding at night, past the number of hours when someone can safely work in a factory. You wonder why we obsess about 60 hours of working time in a factory, not with a code that says, yeah, most of the time except in peak times. The problem is all you need is one time that's not a peak time, like the week before my father's wedding, and my dad was standing next to my grandfather's hand got caught in the machine, his fingers got torn off. My dad tied the tourniquet around his father's elbow to keep him from bleeding to death. So I got a craftsman who's making his living with less fingers than he came to work with in the morning. To me, it's always been a relatively straight thing. We may have published our first code in 1994, but the question has never been open in our minds whether or not we have responsibility for the dignity of folks in the factory. We've always had the clear view that it's personal in a family sense. One more anecdote, and I'll move past it and just tell you that when I was 12 years old, I was working in a factory because that's what I did in the summer, right? Struggling little family business. Now it's a struggling big family business, but it's the same idea, right? I do different things, and I'm glad because I was working, okay, I overstate the verb. I was attending people who were working on moving a machine from the lasting room. And you talk about sensual experiences. It sounds like a factory, and it feels like a factory. I was 11 years old, and this guy working next to me named Hank. Hank smelled like peppermint at 7 o'clock in the morning in New Hampshire. And I thought that was such a wonderful smell. And I was 11 years old, and I didn't realize he was soused out of his mind. Now, that's in an OSHA-certified factory. That's where we're complying on every level with local law. That's where we're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing, except that, as my dad pointed out to me afterwards, I wasn't doing all I was supposed to do because I didn't realize he was drunk. And when the pallet tipped over and crushed his hand, right, I was standing there. And so compliant, we were 110% compliant with all local relevant law, but that didn't protect Hank's hand. And so my experience of codes and the notion of policing is, yes, we have to do that, but that's necessary. It's not sufficient. In 2002, we expanded the notion of code to understand that there is a human environment, there's also a physical environment, and so there are compliance questions about chemicals and resources in factories, and we added that to our view of what needs to be viewed and understood in terms of the checklist. But in 2005, and I give credit to stakeholders like you, we had what I call sort of a real pivot point in the way we think about this notion of dignity for people in the supply chain. And the fundamental, I mean, it's going to sound a little naive, but here you go anyways. We were in the mode of generating checklists. We are auditing like nobody's business. In come the audit teams to tell you, here's what's not right. Here come the remediation plans and all the follow-up that goes with it. And you know what we found is time after time, the same problems in the same factories. People would remediate them and the result would degrade. And if you are a worker in the factory, your experience of it was, hey, Timberland has good intentions. They have a great code. They show up with bright, shiny faces. But my own experience of this doesn't fundamentally change, except episodically, not sustainably. And so the big pivot in 2005, pushed by stakeholders, is we decided instead of policing around the factory experience, we're going to reframe our conversation from the inside out. We're going to put the worker not as a factor of production that need to be protected. We put the worker at the center of the conversation and look through his eyes or her eyes and say, what is it that we need to do to fundamentally address the challenges that you face as somebody working in a shoe factory, whether it's in Bangladesh or it's in China or it's in the Dominican Republic. It was a very sharp pivot in our worldview. It put real challenge on our team because we go from checklists and policing to actually our job is to fundamentally address the imbalances or the breaks in the system. And that's a different challenge in terms of capacity building. It's a different approach in terms of how you talk to floor supervisors in factories and factory owners, because you can't not be, I know that's not a good sentence, you can't not be compliant, but you can also not tell yourself that compliance is a solution in any form, because unless you go at the heart, right, of what's really causing the compliance issue in the first place, you're going to be in a police mode forever. We have 300 factories that touch Timberland products, whether it's a licensee's factory or our factories or a contract factory. That's 250,000 workers that are being involved with Timberland during the year, and the fact is you can't scale your police efforts to that level. You've got to change the mentality that says there's 250,000 people, and if you actually talk to them the right way, there aren't 250,000 asks. There's a relatively common view of what I need in order to self-determine, what I need in order to live a dignified existence while I make boots or shoes or clothes. And by shifting our mentality to that conversation, we've ended up, and I think, in a very different place. Now, practically, we look at our world as three tiers. We have tier one factories, which are factories that touch finished goods, and whether it's they're making, whether it's a licensee's factory or Timberland's factory, it doesn't matter. If it's got our logo on it, that's our responsibility. Tier 2 factories are major suppliers of raw materials, global contract manufacturers, sub-assembly folks. Tier 1 factories are subject to all the rigor of compliance and social change. Tier 2 factories are subjected to the same Tier 3 factories, which is the rest of them. I don't know, right? We're episodic. We're well-intended. We're as focused as we can be. And frankly, that's where the network of the partners that we work with, from CARE to Verite to SAI, folks like that, that's where we have to help. We need help from one another, industry groups, to get leverage, because there are too many places for us to police. Anyways, we do monitor the impact of our programs closely. We track and we report performance indicators. We publish that, both of the targets that we set and the quarterly KPI results. We put them online at the Just Means site. We also, of course, published on our website, has since 2006, the names and the addresses of our factories. I am mystified why every good brand doesn't do the same, because I can tell you, the outcome of having published the names of the factories, by the way, we put them on our shoeboxes too. On the shoebox, it tells you it's made at Pao Chen, and here's where it's made. The outcome of that is a giant nothing, meaning I can't say we've ever gotten an inquiry, what does this mean? But there's a huge, you know, whining between brands and activists about published factory names. All I can tell you is our experience is it was a giant non-event. Actually, we're proud of where we manufacture, and so we're glad to put the names there. Anyways, all that's great. We have a code that demands more than compliance. We have a process that centers around the worker in the context of his or her factory experience. We're thoughtful about the living conditions, we're thoughtful about the working conditions, we're obsessive about things like child labor, environmental standards. We're nutty. We require overtime to be paid at a premium no matter what the local law says, and we have a zero tolerance stance on working hours over 60 hours per week. Look, I'm in the same business as most of our competitors. How's that for a dumb statement? I'm in the same business of all of our competitors, and so I have peak times too. Actually, I could use more peak than I'm getting right now given the economy, but that is, from my view, right, Reverend Schilling? From my pew, that's not licensed to say this is the number of hours somebody should work during the week, except at times when I need them to work more. Because if you think through the perspective of the worker, it doesn't matter how many hours you worked 2 months ago. The danger working past 60 hours a week this week, even if it's a peak time for you, old brand owner, it means I'm in danger. And that's why we're maniacal about saying 60 hours, and we just don't have room for flexibility on this point, which puts real pressure on our business system, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, all this is great, except that if your ears are open and your heart's open, good enough isn't good enough, great, and we listen. And we hear voices, and Reverend Schilling's is one of them, which argue that brands need to do more than simply comply on the level of making sure you pay minimum wage. In fact, there's an assertion out there that I think everybody in the call has heard and some have made, that we need to think more about a sustainable wage or a living wage, because so say those that assert, complying with a minimum wage doesn't necessarily put the worker in a position where he or she can meet their basic needs or enjoy access to, you know, a kind of sort of standard of living that seems on its face pretty straightforward. Nutritious food, medical service, housing, child care and schooling, transportation, some recreation, some skills development, access to a credit system. So ask yourself, you know, who can disagree with that definition? Shouldn't every human that seeks to be able to earn such a living wage? You know, the question is not should they be able to have access to these outcomes. The question that I would love us to push at together is what's the best way to address this notion of delivering an objective? Because it may not be as simple as saying raise wage rates. And I'll give you a specific example what we've seen in our experience in our world. I'll give you a specific example in Bangladesh. We've worked with CARE for a long time against the notion of microfinance facilities for migrant women who are working in the Chittagong export zone in Bangladesh with a Korean-owned company. So this is not Timberland. This is Young One, which is a very fine manufacturer of apparel. We're also a relatively minor player in the apparel business, so we don't have great leverage. So you got a principled company in Young One. You got a small customer in Timberland. You got a faraway place from Stratham, New Hampshire, 03885, and yet we got a real passion about thinking about this through the eyes of the worker. You got migrant women, this is a, you know, classic story, right? They're working away from home, they're remitting their paychecks week after week after week, because, and they're sending them home. Why? Because they want to self-determine. They want to raise their children the same way you and I want to do the same. And so so the answer is, like, you know, they're not having a great time. Are they getting sustainable wages? Is this a living wage environment? Actually, it turns out, right, that for a relatively modest investment over time, we've been able to be partners in a microfinance program that's made 17,500 of these women participants, CEOs of their own sort, right? They've borrowed $2.6 million to date. They're paying it back. They're borrowing, on average, less than $100 per loan. When they pay it back with some nominal version of interest. The consequence of that is you get a powerful person that goes from being a factor in production to being a powerful leader, and you get a sustainable program that Timberland can step back from and expect that it will continue to operate. It wasn't about raising wages, it was about creating infrastructure so these women could have access to a capital system. Because you can raise their wages all you want, but if there's no way for them to save or to borrow, then the system, it's not a closed system, it's an open system, and all that good intention sort of peters out. So the bottom line is we are committed to being part of this conversation, part of the practical solution, which is aimed at ensuring the dignity of the worker in the global supply chain. We're committed to living values beyond compliance, which includes, therefore, grappling with the complex social challenges that factory workers face in the developing economy. As a consequence, we end up in conversations about social policy that I say honestly, as a boot guy, I never thought we'd end up talking about, and yet here we are. And with this conversation today, I hope we'll progress the conversation towards better and more sustainable solutions. In that spirit, I want to pass the call now to Reverend David Schilling, who is the Program Director for the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. As many of you know, those who are on the call, Reverend Schilling has worked for the past 14 years with ICCR members and associates on a range of global corporate accountability issues, including human rights and labor rights in the contract supplier system. Through dialogue with brands and by filing shareholder resolutions, ICCR members have promoted the adoption of corporate programs, policies, and practices to enhance social, environmental, and economic performance, and to report publicly to stakeholders. Reverend Schilling, thank you for participating in the stakeholder engagement. Look forward to listening to you.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. And Jeffrey, you have really done a wonderful job in terms of setting up the context for our conversation around responsible sourcing. You know, it is interesting, as working with the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, many of you know us directly because we've worked directly with you if you're part of companies or part of monitoring firms that have worked in this area. But really, we started working on supply chain issues that came out of a deep commitment to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the ILO Core Labor Standards. And it's really important, I think, to really highlight, particularly the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the importance of that document in terms of understanding, you know, sort of the overarching plane that we're working on when we look at issues related to workplace human rights and community rights within factories and within the communities where factories are sourced. So it's a real privilege to be with you. The work that I've done with our members, I think, is in 14 years, is sort of the pattern, Jeffrey, that you described, where early on, you know, our goal was to get companies to adopt policies, you know, whether codes of conduct, codes of vendor conduct for their supply chain, and then begin to implement those. And in the early days, in 94, 95, 96, I think a lot of that discussion was really highlighted by the sort of the anti-sweatshop movement. We remember Kathy Lee Gifford and her, you know, apparel being made at Global Fashions in Honduras under a private label to Walmart, and how that kind of fueled concern around what are the conditions under which products are being made. So for us, we have been a part of this work along with many of you to really try to draw the link between responsibility all the way across the supply chain. And certainly that includes companies. It certainly includes investors in companies. It definitely includes the, you know, the suppliers themselves, the owners, the factory managers, the supervisors, the workers, and then the communities from which workers come. So I think there's the universe that you're describing, Jeffrey, is really the one that we've been working in for a long time. And since the 90s, a lot has changed. But we have to say, unfortunately, a lot has remained the same. I think what has changed is that we find that there are many, many more committed people within companies that really understand the challenges of creating responsible supply chains and are doing a couple of things. One, trying to find more creative ways to do that, to get around, Jeffrey, what you described as, you know, the kind of you audit, you find an issue, it gets remediated, but then you find it again. And I think we're at a place now where there's some creative, you know, alternatives that are being piloted and hopefully will be mainstreamed, you know, across the board. I think the other is that, you know, a lot of allies within companies are seeing that this isn't just a question of, you know, supply chain. It's a question of the entire company's, you know, code of ethics and its focus on corporate responsibility. So a lot of effort, I think, is going on right now, which I think is really well placed to, you know, to press, you know, the social accountability, the corporate responsibility across the entire company, and especially to make sure that on the procurement side, the buyer side, there's a real alignment with those that are working vigorously to uphold workplace human rights. I just was in a factory last week in southern China where, you know, here you had the code, supplier conduct that was really calling for a certain number of hours. And, Jeffrey, you were describing your code, which I think is a good one in terms of the 60-hour limit. We found out that, you know, looking at the audit record over the last two or three audits, that the hours of work had, you know, been way up, egregious violations of the work hours. And, you know, here we were, you know, talking to the factory manager, and we find out that at least one of the orders where the spike of work went up was placed by a buyer of this company that really wanted the product in 4 weeks, and it really took us the factory 6 weeks to do it. So obviously the workers worked long hours to get the order done in 4 weeks. And I think part of it is to really look at a lot of those purchasing practices, and that, to me, is really helping us, you know, identify not just what suppliers need to change, but also what company sourcing processes need to change. So I think, you know, we have evolved tremendously since the mid-90s. The question still is how to drive systemic change. And I think a lot of us, many on the call and others working in, you know, in Asia and Africa and Latin America, Central America, are really, you know, fatigued by the kind of audit approach that doesn't really address the systemic issues. But it's really easy to say that. It's harder to put in place the mechanisms in factories. Some of you on the call have worked with us in Project Kaleidoscope with 10 factories in southern China producing for Walt Disney Company and for McDonald's Corporation. And this project was really designed to figure out how do you get beyond the, you know, the monitoring that provides some data but doesn't get you kind of the root causes, nor does it get you into a position where the factory management workers, et cetera, are working to really solve problems as they occur. So through that project, took about 3 years, but some of the learnings, Jeffrey, are very, you know, consistent with where your program is going. And that kind of pivotal moment in 2005, when you realize that, you know, while the auditing has gotten us so far, it really hasn't embedded the kind of, you know, sort of culture of compliance in factories that we want to see. And I think part of that, part of the solution here is what you said earlier about really sort of centering in on, you know, workers and making them a center of the conversation. From the beginning of the Code of Conduct enterprise, we were deeply concerned that often codes would be done without any consultation with workers. And I think increasingly those that are working in a whole variety of ways globally in factories are recognizing that, you know, good, you know, freely run trade unions can make a huge difference in terms of improving conditions over time. In areas where that's not the case, to have effective worker committees that are working to identify issues and aren't afraid to bring them forward, to create a you know, kind of a communication network. But it's more than that. It's really creating a measure of justice within the factory so that workers feel comfortable raising issues as they see them and they can be addressed in real time rather than waiting for, you know, a monitoring visit of one brand or retailer or another. Mm. I think you know, the only way we're going to really make progress is to really look at it as a multi-stakeholder, long-term initiative. And the components, you know, are already, you know, emerging in terms of more, you know, root cause analysis, more supplier, you know, ownership of the process. I think, you know, historically we've seen changes within companies' approach where initially, you know, the procurement process was very tactical, and sometimes it was even, you know, put across broadly a company, not really centralized. But as this, you know, the whole process has emerged, I think there's been much more strategic procurement, which has led to longer lasting, smaller supplier bases. And I think a lot of companies are working on this. And if this really holds true, then suppliers can become real partners and become much more open and transparent with their customers and where they're going. That is a critical, critical piece in terms of the culture of compliance and moving this forward as partners. I think another piece is, as you were mentioning, Jeffrey, in terms of the question of the living wage. You know, it's really true that as you're looking at the whole globalization process, and certainly Kofi Annan identified this, you know, a few years ago, where he really, just before the Global Compact was put together, saying essentially that this form of globalization is really, you know, extending the gap between the rich and the poor. And if it's going to work for everyone, we're going to have to find ways to get resources to the poor. Well, in factories, you know, that's a case study. Difficult, partly because of the competitive nature of, you know, the apparel business and other businesses as well. But I do think that at the very least, the focus on living wage has made it more likely that the, you know, minimum wage and overtime is being paid correctly, although I've visited a number of factories recently where that isn't the case. There's still a lot of work to be done. But as, you know, a company like Timberland and as other companies source with long-term partners, you know, one of the scorecard measures should be, you know, the wage level, you know, moving way beyond the minimum wage. And I think that'll help in terms of, you know, worker turnover, et cetera. One factory I visited last week in China, 10% a month, you know, was the rate of turnover, which means that factory and the supplier that's working with that factory is looking for workers every day to replace those that are leaving. Why are they leaving? And part of it is, you know, conditions within the factory, but it's also in terms of wages and the way in which that can sustain an individual and their responsibilities within their family. I do really think that we need to address the issue in multiple ways, but not to give that one up within the factory, but also to look at it from the perspective of the community. The microfinance program that you described, you know, Jeffrey, is really very, very important in terms of, you know, providing income, but also skills, you know, in terms of management of money, et cetera. So we don't, it's not a one-size-fits-all, but we definitely need to not give up on, you know, the issue of wages within the factory, as well as creative ways that, you know, other companies have looked at for some time. I remember, I think there are several folks on the call from Nike and Gap. You know, there was the Global Alliance for Workers and Communities that was formed by Nike, Mattel, you know, some years ago, that really tried to address some of the community issues by doing surveys of workers and then, you know, funding particular projects, whether they be health clinics, et cetera. I think that's part of the solution, but we also need to look at fair compensation. And, you know, if we take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights sort of wage plank, it really talks about, you know, sufficiencies. Wage is sufficient to meet the basic food, clothing, shelter, medical care, and continuous improvement of living standard. That's the goal. We ain't there yet, but I do think that working in a context of not just, you know, having the companies be the responsible agents, but to look at responsibility from the perspective of a whole variety of stakeholders within communities, including civil society, and we cannot forget government. We're not going to be able to really solve a lot of these issues until we're able to get government involved. And that includes enforcement of laws, that includes a real understanding that, you know, a high road to development is going to make a long-term difference for a full economy. So I'm going to stop there and, look forward to further discussion.
Well, I look forward to the same, and I thank you for a breathless tour around the world of what is, and more importantly, your views of what needs to be. We'll need to return to some of those points because there's a lot to discuss there. I'd like to invite Mindy Luber, if you don't mind, Mindy, to share your perspective, and then I want us to get back as quickly as we can to the stakeholders on the call so that we can engage with what Reverend Schilling had to say.
Great. Thank you, Jeff and the Reverend. You both make incredibly important points and laid out enough context that I'm going to be brief and try and highlight some specific things about how we might address these issues. But the very short background that I'll suggest is we all know this isn't easy stuff. We're in the middle of an economic crisis, and for some companies, this may very well be the first to go, or they may suggest. Despite the fact that shareholders, that other stakeholders have made it clear that for many companies, their largest impact footprint on social justice, on the environment, on worker issues is through their supply chain. And so it is going to take leadership, and Jeff has been exercising that in almost unparalleled ways, Nike and some others that are out there, but not a lot in terms of understanding that this needs to be integrated into the business model for business purposes, not only for human purposes, and it's hard to separate them. But a given is it's not going to be easy. Another given is it has to happen. Another given is it cannot be looked at as a special social justice cause for a company. It must be integrated into the business plan for good, smart reasons, that having a workforce that's healthy, that's safe, in the end is going to keep people longer, is going to enable companies to make better products, is going to deal with issues that are fundamental to a business equation. And Jeff gets that, and Jeff, I don't understand why we can't take your brain and implant it across the landscape of business leaders, but it's that thinking that makes sense, at least to many of us on all fronts, and I applaud your leadership. It's been great. And David, what you've done to move the advocacy community into articulating this is equally as commendable, and you've got nothing but my great admiration. Let me mention a few things for what we might talk about on this call, and Jeff has framed some great questions, but I want to mention a few things. One is the need for working together to bring sustainability solutions into it, and I don't mean that in a kumbaya way, let's get together and hold hands and hope we could all share ideas, but what are the models out there where businesses defied what business so often does, which is compete for at all costs, and sharing information or efforts is frowned upon. This model will work if there are collaborative efforts, and it won't work if every business is asked to stand on their own, you know, float on their own bottom or stand on their own 2 feet. We've got to make it the norm, the standard, not the exception, as Jeff has been on so many things. Another issue we need to focus on is capacity building. Both David and Jeff talked about innovative collaborative initiatives. It is clear that collaboration that focuses on streamlining auditing to redirecting a focus to capacity building is key, involving the workers, making sure they have the skills, the capability, the talents. Where else do we export these models to? The World Economic Forum, which has never been the bastion of bleeding heart liberalism, but a very traditional business environment, is starting to look at this and take it. But how do we get real uptake? I know, again, Nike has been involved with an effort. Timberland's leadership is a model for best practices to share. But how do we make sure these models are looked at world convenings of business leaders? And I'd love to be helpful in that regard to Jeff and to others in making sure that happens? And then how do we find the right models to follow? The Electronics Industry Citizenship Coalition, you know, defied traditional ways of doing business. They had a major focus to develop and implement an industry-wide shared code of conduct, and out of that started studying root causes, really working and making a difference. So I want to say that we need to look at collaborative efforts. We need to focus on capacity building. We need to look at other business venues to insert this discussion and focus on it like a laser and make sure there's broader uptake. We need to understand these are tough markets and that the leadership we're listening to and thinking about is still only the exception rather than the rule. We're not seeing anywhere near enough large companies engaged in codes of conduct as it relates to their suppliers, and we need to make sure we think about the ripe and key places for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are areas for discussion. I want to mention three more things for moving forward, be very brief, and then hand this back to Jeff to support an engaging conversation. But moving forward, we need to also make sure that we're rewarding innovation. Innovation is smart. It does need to be integrated into business models over time. I think it will be very clear. It is about building share value of companies, not just costing money on good, cool projects. But we want to make sure that there's disclosure on beyond factory wall efforts. So stakeholders who have labeled this a priority see, understand when a company is systematizing these efforts, and really reward companies for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I think building and maintaining relationships is key, multi-brand collaborative efforts and bringing stakeholders in to build those is important, and three, public policy. Some companies somehow think they want to do what is good for their company, and those companies should be rewarded if, in fact, they're factoring in efforts like this. How do you get and reach supply chain? But in the end, it ought not to be the good guys out front exercising leadership, but for 5 years expending important resources to do something, and most of the population of companies lagging behind. And in the end, the level playing field has to be set by public policy. So how leaders within the financial and business sectors support public policy, I think, is another important thing to take a look at. We want to make sure this is not the exception. It is terrific to have leaders like Jeff, but how do we collectively make sure it's the rule and that there's a level playing field for all players involved? I want to stop there and hopefully be able to join this inspiring discussion. So I am done and turn it back to you, Jeff. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to offer those thoughts.
We are grateful for what you have to say and even more what you have to do. That is both you and Reverend Schilling. We are, I feel a little bit like, is it Scylla and Charybdis where the guy tries to sail a sailboat through and he's having a hard time? I feel a little bit like Scylla and Charybdis in the frame of the conversation, because Reverend Schilling says, hey, it's good to work on microfinance. It's good to understand that there's an outside-the-factory experience, but don't lose sight of the fact that people need to earn a sustainable wage. And I hear what you say, Mindy, about the point that innovation should be rewarded, and I also hear the point that we all feel vibrating, which is that the system is incredibly vulnerable. Reverend Schilling says there's more people committed to it, but they're at the same time fatigued by the rate of progress and the volume of progress. And so the synthesis of these points is really, really challenging for me to listen to. I say humbly, because the framework is good enough, is not good enough, that's fine. The framework is the interdependencies that we've either been willfully blind to or just simply naive about. The interdependencies are startlingly clear. Some bourgeois real estate speculator in Florida puts Iceland out of business. We would have thought that's not likely, right? Or let's put it, I wouldn't have seen that interconnection. And we have a governance model that is very nation-state oriented. It's not across nation-state boundaries, and yet our value chain absolutely snakes across every geography in the whole world. So different cultures, different economic realities, different local jurisdictions. And so the net is, how do you create a comprehensive view of dignity across the social, across this value channel in a way that is, that's not incredibly naive? Because you're absolutely right. I forget it was Mindy or the Reverend that said this. Nobody's going to do this by themselves. Not even the biggest, most powerful companies that aren't trying. But even if the biggest, most powerful companies were being unilateral about it, they would be advancing the agenda, but they won't be solving the problem. Mindy made reference to Davos. I went to the last one. Actually, everybody terminal likes it when I go away, so I went, and everybody was happy about that. But they forget I come back, and then I bring back what I heard. And the conversation there was all about this notion of, if you think about the number of industries and governments and activists that are involved in the value chain of a small shoe manufacturer from New Hampshire, it gets to be very quickly daunting. It really does. You think about something as simple as our carbon footprint, and you think about the number of industries that we have to influence and have connection with and collaboration with in order to minimize carbon footprint. We're not talking about that. I'm talking about human rights, but they are the same point, which is to say, it doesn't matter how good your intentions are. It doesn't even matter how zealous you are per se as an enterprise. You will die on this battlefield called, I can solve this problem. And so Mindy points out this, it's like an awkward high school dance. The boys on one side and the girls on the other. You're saying, we're going to have to figure a way to collaborate. So look, well, there's all sorts of real practical challenges. Collaborate within the industry, that means Timberland and Nike have to hang out. Well, we're absolutely arch enemies in the world of commerce. Now, I give them, I don't know if they're on the call or not, but it doesn't matter. I give them sharp credit for their willingness to share and their willingness to collaborate against thorny issues. We've learned more about, for example, the question of gasification of raw material, which is a local energy, renewable energy source. We learned more about that and water-based adhesives from Nike than from any of our suppliers. And so there is collaboration in our space, but there is limits to how far that can go, both from a commerce perspective, but more importantly, from a problem-solving perspective. Because even if let's pretend Gap is in the Chittagong Export Zone with us, they can help. If we do microfinance and they work on HIV/AIDS, who's working on kindergarten? Or who's working on transportation systems? Or who's working on renewable energy systems so that that we can get three-dimensional social change, even in one specific geography? Even if everybody in our industry was committed to it, which they're not, and if everybody in the industry was willing to share, which they're not, then we would be much further than we are, but we wouldn't be at the three-dimensional sustainable social change that Reverend Schilling demands, right, that we be about. And so I'm in the how far can we go? Well, the answer is clearly not far enough, but that's not a helpful answer. I'm asking stakeholders on the call to help me and help each other engage in this point, which is maybe the answer is, look, let's just focus on compliance and hope somebody else comes up with a social change that's sustainable. But I can tell you, that's not our thesis. I would love to hear people's questions or comments or concerns about this notion of what is the role of the brand? Does it end at the level of the factory floor, we complied? Does it go further? How can we build a sustainable approach to dignity, not in a compliance mode? So we're open for conversations and questions. I think we actually have somebody who's ready to ask a question. Operator, can you open up for questions? Uh-oh, I talked the operator to death. Craig Moss, are you there? Uh-oh.
Social accountability.
On the line.
Craig?
Yeah, hi, Jeff. This is Craig Moss from Social Accountability International. I have a brief comment and observation and then a question for you. From our point of view, I mean, what I'm hearing is a lot of the things we've been working on. Mm-hmm. And clearly CSR has to be positioned as an investment inside the company and shifted away from being considered a cost. We're really focused now on integrating sourcing and compliance inside the brands and retailers as one of the key elements to sustainable change. We think that clearly the brand responsibility is in the factory. And in the factory, we think that management systems are the key to sustainable change. And I think that pretty much a lot of other organizations are coming to that same conclusion. As people start to shift from monitoring to capacity building, you need to have the systems in place in the suppliers to be able to sustain that. So whatever you train, whatever you teach, you need to have a system there for them to be able to receive it and be able to implement over time. Outside the factory wall, we think here that the brand, you know, our code has a living wage provision. So we strongly believe that that's an element, and you have to look at the worker's life outside of the factory also. We think that the influence that the brands have to impact the lives outside the factory has to be part of the next 5 years. And we think that there's some really interesting things being done in that area, and that it is important for brands to tie the shift toward capacity building in your suppliers with community development initiatives. And one of the things that we've seen, one of our corporate members, Gap Inc., is working on a project where they are providing worker training targeted primarily for female workers, where they're helping them with training to improve their performance in the job and actual management training. In addition to that, they provide life skills training. So here's a really interesting model where the factory manager benefits through a workforce that's better trained and motivated and able to make more money. The community also benefits at the same time, and the brand benefits. And we think this kind of creative solutions is really critical, but that business has to be a driver. We have to be pragmatic as moving forward, that business is the driver behind this, and it has to be integrated in. Having said that, my question for you, over the next 5 years, do you see Timberland starting to link your efforts to improve compliance inside the factory with initiatives to directly tied to improving the community?
Well, that's a hard question. The first thing to say is I think your insight about what are we good at in terms of capacity building as brands, shouldn't we be able to help factories with management systems? The answer is definitively yes. This is something we do all day long, right? So if we can prepare our financial results for every 90 days to share, then we should be able to help the factories develop whatever operating systems they need in order to ensure compliance. And I absolutely agree with that view. It's very, very hard to make the case that that's not good news, that's not good, period, for a couple of reasons. One is outcomes will shift in the factory, right? So we will become compliant. Of course, just from pragmatic business perspective, it's so much better, Craig, if the other guy, if the factory owner takes this on. It's within his competence. No matter how vigilant we are as auditors, they're in the factory 24 hours a day, or at least they're in the factory 7 days a week, and maybe they shouldn't be. Maybe it should be 6 days a week, but the point
six.
Is, they,
no
right, exactly. They're there, and they're living there, and it's so much better if they're operating systems that are their systems. So I agree with you. That's a sustainable notion. If we can teach rather than lecture, we'll be in a much better place. That's inside the factory. Outside the factory, you're right to point out that community development's always been a part of our approach, and we've worked very hard to create an outside the factory set of circumstances and an inside the factory set of circumstances. And your challenge, as I hear it, is to make sure that we're being explicit about linking those things. And to me, that's an opportunity for value creation. And I appreciate the challenge. Most of it, what we've done in community development, if you take I'll give you a specific in the Dominican Republic, where we've had a factory for 20-plus years, the distinction between in and out of the factory isn't a relevant one to us because we know folks. We live there, right? And so inside the factory is the man who's working in the hand-sewing department, and outside the factory is the guy that can't get to work because there's not a public transportation system. Or outside the factory is the woman who works in the lasting department whose kids don't get access to kindergarten. Even though the Dominican Republic has public schools, they don't have kindergartens. They don't fund them. Or there's a young couple working in the factory, him in one place and her in the other, and because it's a developing economy, there is a relatively monopolistic relatively monopolistic control of basic foodstuffs. And so, to the Reverend Schilling's point, we pay a fair wage, except that the price of basic foodstuff in the Dominican Republic is almost
Shut
as expensive.
Up.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
Yep.
Relative, what I pay in suburban Newton at a Whole Foods store is not far different that folks are facing in a factory environment, a developing environment, come, that's ridiculous. And so, you know, Craig, to your point, so I got into the food business. So we have to be able to buy raw food stuff and then mm-hmm. Provide it to employees, not in a paternalistic way, but in a order the brands that you want and pay a fair price, not an inflated price. So that's community development on the outside. That's mm-hmm. that's social justice on the inside, creating sustainable links. It's easier for us so far, to Mindy's point, to do that in our own factory than it's been able to do in other people's factory, and that's one of the real problems that we face in some of the environments that we do business, where I don't know how to influence the cost of basic food or access to medical care except in a project-by-project basis. And so I look up to Steve Hill, Craig, and I say, your point is right, that there has to be an internal strategy inside the factory that's based on systemic development of capacity, skills, and there has to be real community development, and there's going to be a link between them. I think it rubs right up against Mindy's point, though. In the Dominican, we can do a three-dimensional thing because we got 2,000 workers there and a big commitment, and when we're in the Chittagong export zone, we've been only successful working on things like microfinance. We haven't addressed the issue of education in Bangladesh, and I honestly don't know what to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
No, thank you for your response on that. I think there are opportunities that if you put the factory owners into the equation and thinking how they also benefit from this, I think that, again, shifting capacity to them requires training, but if you can help them to elevate workers within their factories and provide that kind of training that helps the people there advance in within the company, everybody benefits. And we're doing a couple research studies with Harvard now looking at trying to quantify things like employee retention improvement.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's also where brands can play a valuable role. You have the financial management and skills that you could start to put together programs or packages for your suppliers that would help them to understand the actual cost saving. If our if our employee retention rate improves, there actually is a dollar cost saving to that.
Yep.
Too much of the talk now is very soft about those kind of issues. And my background's business, and we need to quantify those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very fair point. It is. Are there on the call, my colleagues tell me we have other brands, and if we do, and there's wisdom in the network, I would be glad and grateful to receive your wisdom. If you have questions or comments, all you got to do is sort of queue up with the operator and jump right in. I'm tired of listening to me. I bet you are too. So I'm very interested to hear what other sharp folks like Craig have to say. So go ahead, fire away. Tough questions.
Could we open the call?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star 1 at this time. Our first question comes from Monte Allen with CARE. Please go ahead.
Hi, Jess and everybody. I don't know if you can hear me, if I'm patching.
Yep,
okay.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make just a couple of observations. Just first of all, a really big picture. If we're going to lift the human condition, it can't all be done by governments. It can't all be done by faith-based entities. It can't all be done by academia or by NGOs. It won't be done unless the private sector is a major player. So my hope is that the answer to the question of where does a brand's responsibility lie goes beyond the factory setting and lies beyond the factory walls.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a couple of other things I wanted to say. One is that with regard to capacity building, the experience that that Karen Timberland have in our collaboration in Bangladesh is I think, illustrative of a good trend, and that is aiming towards sustainability of the benefits that our project collaboration has put in place. And in terms of capacity building, our focus has been on building the capacity not just of workers, but of community entities, local nonprofits.
Can you get that signal?
Hello?
I hear you, Monty. Go ahead.
Oh,
go ahead.
Civic governments, local nonprofits, local entities that to whom we can transfer the responsibility for carrying forward the project activities that we have been able to put in place in Lend and Care during the course of our three-year project. And that is where the sustainability can come from. Once we
Monty?
I think we lost him.
I hope not, because the world would be much the poorer for it.
Yeah.
I understood the point, back to your relatively profound one, very consistent with what Craig said about the need to build systemic capability.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Monty saying that, yes, absolutely. First, two things. One is absolutely business has a role, and what's reassuring about the point is he actually speaks directly to the concern I was trying to frame, which is, it's all I can do to figure out how to run a boot company, for crying out loud. How am I supposed to build a model for social change? And he said back, why don't you do what you're good at? Craig said the same thing. Focus on sort of running the business. And if you think about what the business is, right? Craig said management systems that ensure compliance in the factory. Monty said, okay, that the next thing you can do outside of the factory, right, is work on using that same business planning process to help build capacity, I think he was saying, in NGOs, in activists, local organizations that can set a leverage model that says, if you teach a management factory, a management team in the factory how to ensure compliance, then you can take that resource and maybe start to work with a local NGO and help them build capacity. And if they've taken on what they can take on, then you have resource to develop or to focus on the next level of community building. To me, that's actually a very reassuring model that says, do what you're good at, do it in a sequential, focused way, starting inside the factory, but with a clear commitment to getting outside the factory. I'm sorry we lost him in mid-stride, because mm-hmm. I'm not sure mm-hmm. if that was his point, but at least I'll tell you that's what I learned from it. And I'm looking for, not reassurance, but I'm looking for I'm looking for some hope, and I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Operator, are there anybody else out there that wants to tell us how to think or what to think?
Monty is online again. Go ahead, sir.
Jeff, you caught most of it. I guess my point was that we want to not only put in place good practices, but to sustain them. And it may just be that, while a company's, a brand's effectiveness can be in putting in place, getting started benefits for workers and stakeholders, the way that those things can be sustained without continually involving the company or its NGO partners is to build the capacity of local entities
yep.
to the point where they can take over these things. And the other thing mm-hmm. I want to say is that if it's the case, as Mindy suggested, that public policy could be doing more in terms of rewarding constructive actions by companies and leveling the playing field so that experiments can be done within the private sector, CARE would be happy to be an advocacy partner with companies mm-hmm. who are interested in working on that front. So I just, you have allies in the nonprofit world that recognize the validity of what Mindy was saying.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be glad to collaborate with you on that front.
Mm-hmm. This is David Schilling. Just maybe a quick point here, because I think the public policy issue is really critical. It's critical in terms of individual countries, but also, providing a global framework. I mean, a lot of us have been engaged and involved with, Professor John Ruggie, the UN Special Representative on Human Rights and Business, reporting to the Human Rights Council. There's some of the work that he's done and collected has been on the supply chain. Obviously, his mandate is broader than that, but I would urge, all of us to really focus in on that process, because Professor Ruggie has a three-year continuation of his mandate, came up with a framework of, states' responsibilities, corporate responsibilities, and then some issues related to some of the access to you know, remediation, et cetera. But I do think that, you know, the supply chain is so critical to that discussion and has been kind of underrepresented. So that is one area where we can work together to try to build some common ground in terms of expectations and then really rules of the road for supply chain compliance, not just within the factories, but looking at some of the broader human rights issues within the community. That's one venue, I think, that's worth pursuing.
I think it's a powerful point because the point about public policy is clear. I don't think anybody disagrees, but the convening or the governance of that question is a complex point. And I continue to worry about the interlocking jurisdictions, the overlapping and competing views. In talking to our Chinese suppliers about renewable energy, it is a different conversation than talking to folks in the public about renewable energy from a public policy perspective. And Timberland's so outside its pay grade in either of those conversations sometimes you wonder, you know, where am I supposed to go to get the right kind of leverage? And so I appreciate the, I don't think that's a small point that the Reverend makes. And I think Mindy made the same point, which is part of what the powerful advocates and activists can do here for the brands is help rationalize these choices. Right? There are too many addresses that you can apply to for a coherent conversation. The net of that is you run around and have the same conversation 1,000 times, and you wonder, okay, and then at least I can speak for myself. You conclude, I can't figure out the public policy. I don't know who to talk to. Everybody wants to talk about it, and which I respect and admire, but like, how do you get something done? And so your point about Professor, you said Ruggie, I think. If that is, it to me would be a very useful thing if the brands in our space got together and said, here's the three places we're going to go to talk about public policy. It beats the daylights out of the 300 that we're currently talking to. That lack of efficiency or market mechanisms means that we spend our goodwill and our good energy and we don't get the same outcome. So I think that's a very helpful comment. Operator, next question, please.
We do have another question from Anna Sandage. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Anna Sandage with Brown Shoe Company, and I'm a social compliance person that's kind of working on the ground with our team in Dongguan. And I have a real basic question. Earlier on, Reverend Schilling mentioned about the creating a culture of compliance by moving from tactical ideas of sourcing to more strategical ideas of sourcing. And from somebody who's working not even in mid-level management, but just on the ground, how do you engage conversations around it is an integrated business model and not just a social justice component to the work you're doing?
Yeah, Reverend, you take a crack?
Sure. So, Anna, you're working in the field in Dongguan?
Well, I'm based in the United States, but we have an audit team in Dongguan,
And what is the structure within Brown Shoe? I mean, where is your place? I mean, is there... Have you know, in terms of your sourcing, do you think that has really been integrated into, you know, at a strategic level, and that you know the social accountability has been built into that, or do you feel like it's not quite there yet?
We're still working to get there. We're definitely in the checklist and police mode.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it really, really helps if you have, a CEO like Jeffrey, who's a champion. I think that makes a big difference. The part of it is a process, I think, of really looking at the advantages of having a sourcing strategy that, you know, is integrated from the get-go, as opposed to, for example, having one part of the company place an order in a factory. You come in later and find some egregious violations, either gets remediated or doesn't, and production has to be stopped. That's just so inefficient at that level. I think partly building the business case, the integration, and I think, you know, Greg from SAI was talking about that as a critical piece of SAI's work. Certainly that's what we've been working on. There are a lot of folks, I think, in this this network, some that are represented on this call could really, you know, maybe speak offline a little bit more in detail of what has worked. You know, I know Nike's on the call. Nike's done a lot of work the last 8-10 years to really mainstream corporate responsibility, because sometimes these initiatives start in a bit of a, like a little ghetto, and it's hard to break into the, you know, the business decision-making process itself. That's where it's got to go. But I think a step-by-step process is, you know, first of all, what you're finding in the factories. And I don't know if you have a pre-certification process where...
No, we don't.
Okay, so it's likely that orders are going to be placed, and then you're going to find out what's
right.
taking place. And right. I think that'll show some of the inefficiencies within the system. You just don't want to get orders put in a factory that won't be, you know, really be able to deal with some of the, you know, ethical standards that you're putting forward, and it's going to mean either intensive work or interruption.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it, I think, is really working to identify people within your structure that are in key decision-making roles, and really have some concerted conversations with them, and possibly, you know, to set up a, you know, a call with some of your, you know, folks within Brown Shoe, just to have this conversation, so that it can help inform, you know, the whole company about and give some real, you know, credibility and depth to what you're doing. But I do think that yes, it's a step-by-step process, and you know, gaining some champions at higher level within the company is really going to make a difference in terms of, you know, shifting from the, you know, the checklist to a broader, more strategic approach.
Anna, we're also here willing to help if we can. Colleen Van Hayden is the expert on our team, and she's going to follow up with you if it's all right.
Oh, that would be great.
Great, that's good.
And I'm also glad if I can be helpful. If you wanted me to talk to somebody in your joint, I'd be glad to do it.
Thank you.
Good.
I know we started a few minutes late, and that was bad luck. And so we're kind of looking at a deadline, but I'll say this. If there are, operator, if there's another question or two, I'd be glad to hang around. And I don't want to keep people waiting past time, but it's an important dialogue. So if there are some more questions, I'm glad to take them.
There isn't no more additional questions at this time.
Okay, well, I'm sorry that we ran late relative to our agenda. That's only late relative to the amount of time we had to spend on it as opposed to the amount of time that it takes. Reverend Schilling and Mindy Luber, thank you for guiding us and teaching us and pushing us. Thanks to all who had questions. If yours didn't get addressed, we're going to post on the Just Means site both the gripping audio file of this, which I think is a social justice thing in its own regard, because if your children can't sleep, they can listen to my voice and fall asleep. But we are going to also host a discussion board there, which is a more important thing, where if you had questions or concerns, there's an opportunity for real interaction. So I end as I began with genuine, sincere thanks to all who participate in this process. Somehow we've got to figure this out,
yep.
And time is a wasting. So thanks to all who participated. I wish everybody a great day.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation for using AT&T Executive Teleconference. You may now disconnect.